my name's Ali, and this is the Rus Files Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I'm joined by a guest, and today I'm actually joined by two guests, the first of whom is a returning guest. So, hi, Jenny.
Hello. I just waved at the microphone. Hello to you all.
Yeah, you wouldn't be the first person to do that. but yes, nice to have you back. It's way back. The second episode I ever released was your one.
That's so. Right. Yeah. No, glad to be back. Thanks very much for asking me. Obviously, I wasn't too terrible, so unless maybe that's why it's taken you so long to ask me again.
No comment.
Wow, that was cold.
But yeah, no, it's a delight to have you back on.
Thank you.
For anyone who hasn't caught that episode that you're on, the Moscow Doesn't Believe in Tears episode.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Jenny. I work for the RSPB. So I spend a lot of time writing about birds, mostly dead ones, actually. The sort of line of work I'm in is to do with illegal killing of birds, of prey mostly. So anyway, that's a bit depressing to start off with, but that's sort of what I do. I ended up doing this bizarre job, which I do enjoy, actually, by sort of doing an English literature degree. I'm sure anyone else who has done an English Lit degree also comes out of it going, okay, what's next?
Bird murder.
Yeah, the natural progression. So I don't murder the birds, let me just be clear.
Yes, that is important.
I condemn the ones that do.
Yes.
But yes, so I met Ali when I was at uni doing English literature. You were doing history, weren't you?
I was, yes. Well, originally politics, but that's a long story.
Yeah, okay. I changed as well, actually.
Oh, okay.
I started off, because you know we did three subjects.
Yes.
I did English, philosophy and psychology.
Did you get in on philosophy?
No. Yes. I liked philosophy, but I didn't like psychology.
Mm.
I found it a bit too sciencey, which sounds stupid, but...
No, I can relate. Like, once I got to, like, A-level science, I was like, No, I'm not that good at this.
I like sort of whimsical theories I can handle, but actual facts and scientific studies? What?
Once it starts to get empirical.
Once there's an actual real answer, yes or no, then it's hard for me.
Yeah, I can relate to not wanting to be pinned down.
Yeah, but, well, I changed to creative writing, so obviously there's no wrong or right answers there. And it was, yeah, I enjoyed that. And actually, by chance, that sort of turned out to define what I went on to do a little bit, working for a newspaper before I worked for the RSPB. So,
and speaking of creative writing, am I allowed to talk about this?
You can mention to the world that I'm writing a novel, but I haven't told all that many people.
Okay.
It's one of these weird things where you feel a bit embarrassed because it sounds a bit like, oh yeah, I'm just, you know, writing my novel. And everyone goes, oh God, another one of those. It's probably rubbish.
Okay, well...
No, I don't mind, but yeah.
Okay, so if you're listening to this podcast, you're not allowed to tell anyone that Jenny's writing a novel until it's published. So, yes,
and don't talk to me about it because it's really embarrassing to talk about.
Okay.
And by the way, everyone, it's really hard. It's really hard to write a book.
Well,
it takes a long time. Who knew?
Yeah. Well, unless you're like Nadine Dorries and just do it alongside being a terrible MP.
Yeah,
sorry,
well.
That got way specific and way personal.
Oh, I was going to say about how I met you, as well as through sort of our course and the literature and film element. We did fencing together.
Yes.
Which is kind of cool. And I haven't done since uni, but at the time it was a really fun sport.
Yeah, I think that was essentially how we met because, you know, obviously, you know, history students and English literature students.
We don't talk to each other.
No. No.
That's not true. We have some things in common.
No, we have a lot of stuff in common. I mean, like uniting against the scientists who say that, oh, well, you're not going to be able to get a job after you graduate.
Even though they're right.
Yeah. Anyway, so I did allude to the fact that there's two guests today. So Carrie's very... much been biding her time patiently, so...
Sorry, while I ramble on. Hey, Carrie!
That's fine. I just thought it was a bit awkward if I jumped in on the conversation before I'd been officially introduced.
Yeah, and I was doing a very poor job of, like, giving you an opportunity to be introduced.
It's fine. I can be patient.
So, Carrie, you've been on quite a few episodes already.
Yes, I have.
But for people just joining us...
I'm legally... required to be in this apartment.
That's even colder.
Yeah. Could you do a little bit more context than that?
I Kelly and I are married.
Yes.
So the legal requirement aspect is because I'm from the States, and as part of the whole immigration stuff, improving our relationship is real. You know, living together is one of the ways that you do that. Mm. So technically, in order to stay in this country, you know, kind of legally required to live together. However,
otherwise they wouldn't be.
Exactly. We try to spend as little time with one another as possible.
Right. How do I follow that? But yeah, so beyond being my spouse and, you know, being crowbarred into this episode.
I studied Russian language and literature in university. And the book, that the movie that we're watching is based off of was one of the ones that we read. And its author is held up as the greatest Russian author that there is and all this other stuff. So we actually did watch this movie in university too.
Mm.
So that's where my connection comes in, Ellie, one in my quote-unquote expertise.
There's more expertise than I have.
Well, I'm coming in very fresh to this, so we'll have a nice mix of
views. Although I kind of feel bad saying, like, oh, it's my expertise, because then if I get absolutely anything wrong...
You mean you can't remember everything spot on from what you studied in university?
I know. It was only...
Oh,
last week?
10-plus years ago.
Stuff that I used to know and I now do not know is worrying.
Yeah.
I sometimes look through, like if I'm back at my parents, look through old textbooks or things, and I wrote that essay? Wow, it's like really good. Like, how did I write that? And I've long forgotten all of those points that I made. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Scary.
Yeah. I feel the same way about this kind of stuff. And I didn't do any research beforehand because I know Ali likes people to come in with like as little knowledge as possible.
To make him look really good.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's all an elaborate scheme to make me seem like this.
It's more like to give people an idea of what watching the movie is actually like, so that you're getting people's real impressions, initial impressions, so that if you choose to watch the movie yourself, you get that kind of good idea about it.
It's all very accessible.
Exactly. Yeah.
But future guests, feel free to do research if you want to. It's not a mandatory, like, you're not allowed to know anything. Anyway. So there was a specific reason, Jen, why I wanted you on this particular film.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of to fulfill a promise I made on the last episode you were on, that if you were back, that we would be discussing a period drama.
Yay! I do love a costume drama, gotta say.
Yes. In fact, I was just re-listening to the episode and you described Little Women, I think it was like the 90s one, as being possibly your favourite film.
Yeah, I think it probably is. I think a lot of my favourite films, I don't know if anyone else has this, were kind of defined in your early teens, or maybe even before that, but certainly I remember watching Little Women, and I've watched it at various stages throughout my life since then, and it's so good! It's so sad, it's so well put together, and it's... I mean, I don't even have any sisters, but so relatable... even though they're sort of women from New England in the sort of 1860s. But there's universal themes.
Without smartphones.
Without smartphones. Maybe it was a better world. But they did have scarlet fever, so it's swings and roundabouts.
You win some, you lose some, yeah.
Oh.
But I mean, it's always a good sign for a film if you can come back to it, you know, this sounds awful, later in life, but look, a few years on and still relate to it and not just be like...
Yeah.
Huh, what was I like that I liked?
Totally, yeah. I guess it's music as well, when you can still listen to the same songs
that
you heard when you were younger and still enjoy them and not think, wow, that was very much my teenage self and I've now moved on. Maybe I just haven't evolved since I was 12. Could be that.
Whereas I'm very much embarrassed by most of the music that I listened to when I was 12 and I don't listen to it anymore.
What I want to hear?
Well, stuff like Backstreet Boys and Spice Girls and whatnot. It's like my parents put up with having that in their house.
But then if Spice Girls came on the radio right now, you wouldn't just be like singing along, surely?
I'd probably be like mock laugh singing along, but not actually enjoying it.
You're allowed to enjoy it ironically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas I probably just would enjoy it. Like, my I do this dance class and they put S Club 7 on for the last song to sort of stretch to.
Oh,
Reach for
goodness.
The Stars. Come on, guys. If you want to feel good, you listen to Reach for the Stars. It's a great tune. they just looked at me like I might actually have to leave the building right now.
Was S Club 7 something that travelled across the Atlantic carrier, or were you spared that?
Well, it was like Hawaii 7 or Miami 7 initially as a TV show, but it was still British.
Yeah.
It was pretty bad.
I don't remember. Pop culture has never been my strong point, as Ellie knows.
Don't read anything into that, love, listeners, please. So, period dramas.
Mm.
What makes a good one, and what's the appeal?
Well, for me, I think it's kind of inhabiting a different life and world. I guess maybe in the same way as you might enjoy sort of fantasy or something that's different from the here and now. So something that's very real and now is great as well, but I do quite often like imagining or kind of inhabiting a life that's very different to my own. And I just like history, I guess. I like the past. I'm very fascinated by how people did things differently then and what life, you know, imagining what life might have been like for just an ordinary person, you know, like yourself, to sort of go back and be in that time. So I guess it's kind of an insight. You get to live this other life that you'd obviously never get to really visit unless you could time travel. It's, to me, the closest to time traveling, potentially.
Yeah, definitely.
Although I did read something good, which I remembered as I was driving over here today, and it was about, because there's a lot of talk, I know, about whenever there's a historical sort of adaptation or a period drama, it's how close it is to reality, obviously. Mm. That can be a problematic thing with the new sort of Mary Queen of Scots film. You know, how have they just shoehorned a few bits in for sort of artistic license or to make a good story? Even the Bohemian Rhapsody film, you know, how much of that is absolutely on the nail true? But for me, it's kind of like, it was this quote that I read. I can't remember who said it, but it said, "All history lies to us. At least historical fiction is honest about that." And I thought that was kind of cool, because the past is a very, you know, hard to put your finger on place. You know, history is very mixed and different theories fall in and out of favour, and you never really know what it was like. But at least with historical fiction, you know it's supposed to be fiction.
Yeah, it's not somebody presenting a version. I mean, you'd hope with an honest historian that any bias is unconscious bias, but there's always the possibility that somebody has an agenda and they're like deliberately spinning things a certain way.
Well, even the first hand sources you're reading, whoever's written that has got some agenda and they feel a certain way, or, you know, the whole kind of history is written by the victors kind of sort of idea.
Yes, yeah, yeah. My whole degree essentially saying, well, this person, can we trust them because X, Y, Z?
Exactly, yeah.
I think that's where costume dramas have a bit of an advantage, because if you're going based off of a book or some story that isn't actually, like, this happened, you're not going to have that level of debate or that type of spin around what the story that you're telling. It's just, is this a compelling story that was set in this time?
Yeah. As long as it's not too way off and you think, okay, why is there some sort of car driving along down the street where the March sisters are going off for Christmas or whatever? Like, that would be obviously make you completely not agree with it and not relate to it, and you'd walk out the cinema, but...
No, this is just a deeply revisionist take, or it's surrealism. Yeah. We're just deliberately introducing anachronistic elements, not because we couldn't be bothered to research. So in terms of the specific thing that we're watching, Carrie, you've already alluded to it.
Mm-hmm. We're watching Eugene Onegin, or is it Yevgeny Onegin?
I think the film is just called Onegin.
Oh, okay. So we're watching Onegin. I apparently didn't know that that's what the movie was called. The book is called Eugene Onegin, or sometimes Yevgeny Onegin.
Yevgeny is a bit more Russian sounding.
It is. It is. But the translation of the name is Eugene, so it's not entirely inaccurate.
It's one of those ones which tends to get, like...
Mm-hmm. I prefer Yevgeny Onegin, but there are differing opinions, so we will allow those to exist.
No. They must be stamped out.
It's my opinion or nothing.
Sorry, this podcast suddenly got very, like...
I'm getting carried away now.
Dictatorial.
Yeah. It's like being on stage. I'm showing off now. Be quiet, Jenny, for God's sake.
I don't know. What did you want me to say?
So, well, you alluded to the status of the author.
Yeah, Pushkin is considered like a demigod, and he's certainly their greatest author. Like, if you go into a museum and there's a portrait of Pushkin, they will have like some sort of rope around it to keep you a certain distance away from the portrait.
Wow.
Mm.
Like, as opposed to the portraits of the other authors and other people that they have hanging on the walls. He's just that revered. He's kind of like, Pushkin is to Russian literature what Shakespeare is to English literature in many ways, except Pushkin didn't just write plays. He wrote poetry. He wrote short stories. The book Yevgeny Onegin itself is a novel in the form of poems. So it's a series of sonnets that put together create a novel. So it's a hybrid form of writing, which is a characteristic of Russian writing.
What period are we talking?
Early 1800s.
Yeah, okay. So whilst he has this kind of Shakespearean status in Russian literature, he's much more recent. Yeah.
Sure. So it's more like sort of when Jane Austen was being published.
Exactly.
Yeah, he was a little bit younger. I think he was born in 1798 or 1799.
Okay.
So he was a kid and growing up when Jane Austen was around.
But
still, it's a similar sort of era. But he was, I think, the first really huge writer that wrote in modern Russian. So that's how he gets his big sort of a deal. And that's part of how he got to be such a big deal.
Yeah, he kind of put Russian on the like European cultural map as a language that you could write literature in, because it was like previous, it kind of had to be French or English.
But he wasn't as revered in his own time as he is now.
Okay.
I do think that's important. To, he had trouble paying his bills because his writing wasn't selling at some certain points. And because like a lot of noble people, he was living well above his means, but that's a completely different topic.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Although we may get on to that in terms of the discussion of the film, perhaps. Because it's more or less a contemporary set piece. It's not like...
For the time, it would have been a set in modern times, as if you're writing a novel about stuff that's happening today.
Sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you very much for that little intro to Pushkin.
Mm-hmm.
I nearly forgot what the name
is. Who is he again?
Yeah.
Really famous.
That guy.
Yeah, well,
with the sideburns.
Yeah, yeah.
He had look up a picture of Pushkin. You really have to. His sideburns are impressive.
Yeah. Kind of quite curly. But then part of that was his descent.
Yeah, he had a great-grandfather or something like that who was African.
Yeah.
I
think it was his grandfather, yeah.
I couldn't remember which generation it was, but yeah, that guy was a favorite of Peter the Great and his court.
Yeah.
And so that's how that ancestry came to be for him.
Oh, you maybe want to go home and research a load about Pushkin. Sounds
interesting guy. It is cool. Yeah, when you know that fact about him, you kind of go, oh, okay. Yeah, you can kind of tell he has some African ancestry. He doesn't look like stereotypically Russian.
Yeah.
But yeah, he does have like the Mr. Darcy sideburns and then some. Awesome. So in terms of the specific adaptation we're watching, it's not actually a Russian film. We sometimes branch out and watch some Western takes. So this one is from 1999 and was directed by Martha Fiennes.
A relation to the other Fiennes?
Yes, yeah. It's actually Rafe and...
Joseph?
He was in...
He was Shakespeare in Love, wasn't he?
The better looking Fiennes brother.
Yeah.
It's probably not.
But less successful one.
Yeah.
At least it was either or. I mean, if one of them was the successful, good looking one, it'd be like, oh, awkward family Christmases.
And you, the black sheep who doesn't do anything.
That must be what, like, isn't there three Hemsworth brothers? There's, like, Chris Liam and another one. I think the other one isn't involved in acting at all, but what must it feel like to be that other brother?
Or Hemsworth, the other Chuckle brother. There's apparently three of them.
Oh, yeah, really?
I know. Huh. Crazy stuff.
Anyway.
On a different end of the spectrum.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. Rest in peace, Barry Chuckle.
Aw.
American listeners, or listeners outside of the UK, to be honest, you might just need to Google the Chuckle Brothers.
And please do. And then feel free to send us your questions. What are they? Why are they carrying ladders all the time?
Yeah.
To me, to you.
Exactly.
See, you've lived here a while.
I've lived here a while. I get this reference.
Is it on the citizenship exam?
No, but it would make a lot more sense if that question were on there than some of the other ones.
Well, you say, yeah, I was going to say, you say that. That's the sort of thing that might be on there just because it's so random. It's not like...
Yeah, but people actually talk about that kind of thing.
What stuff did you get asked?
Well, I've only done looked at some practice tests, but like some of the questions on there will be things like, who set up the first curry shop and in what year in Birmingham?
Well, every English person knows that.
Right.
That's so hard. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the Chuckle Brothers, if they had something on there like, which comedy duo said to me, to you, to me, to you, that would make sense.
Well, which of these was not one of the two Chuckle Brothers?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it would still be kind of harsh to deny somebody citizenship over the fact that they don't know who the Chuckle Brothers are, but...
Yeah. That would be pretty bad.
Call me a bleeding heart liberal.
It's better than not knowing the name of the guy who first opened the first curry restaurant.
Who is it, incidentally?
I have no idea. I don't remember. I did not study this well. I just looked at some of this stuff.
Well, your prospects look pretty dim.
I know.
Actually, my Australian friend has done... It was life in the UK test.
Yeah, yes. That.
Yeah. And she had got loads of history questions that were... I know, I didn't know the answer to a lot of those.
No, that's the common response from people who are actually like, well, it's a good thing we don't all have to do this.
Yeah, the whole country would just be empty.
Yeah. Right. Exile for me.
Apart from a few Chuckle Brothers fans.
Yeah.
Anyway... Moving off politics.
Yes, I'll just randomly diss Nadine Dorries again, just so I can. Might edit around that. So Martha Fiennes, sibling of the other...
Is she older or younger?
You're highlighting the...
difficult question, number one.
Yeah, shallowness of my research. I want to say she's slightly older.
Just make it up, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what IMDb is for. So I think this was just... I watched a couple of extras from the DVD yesterday. It turns out this was like a massive passion project for Ralph Fiennes, and his sister had done directing work before, but not actually directed a movie.
Okay.
But he was kind of like... He talked to her about it, and she was super interested in doing it as well, so...
And there were no major, difficult, complicated fight scenes. So, hey, you can handle this.
Well,
with
I
no
know.
Experience.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, it wasn't like she was working some totally random, non-related job.
Yeah.
Nepotism.
Yeah. How interesting, though, to be directed by your sister. I hope he did what he was told. The fight scenes were actually sibling rivalry, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't imagine working with one of my sisters and having to take orders from them every single day like that. Like, that would just... Any of us would have set stuff on fire by the end.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't have gone well.
Yeah.
It would have been fine for me if I was probably the director, because I have a younger brother, and he'll back me on this one. I was quite bossy as a child, so when we played together and, with Lego or whatever it was... And I'd be like, no, it doesn't work like that. No, you must do it like this. And he was very obliging. But I think as he's grown, now if I tried to do that in a film scenario, do this, do that, he'd be like, no.
You're not
get
the boss of me.
Get out of it.
Yeah, I think...
You'd get out too well.
Yeah, as an eldest sibling myself, I think my younger brothers would be very much like, yeah, if you were directing me, you'd just be bossy and condescending and awful. So no, not doing that. Fortunately, I have no ambitions in that direction. But
Also have no ambitions in the acting direction, so...
What are you talking about? It's going to be a star.
Which one, Matt or Andrew?
Let's go with Matt.
Okay.
It's news to you, Matt. He doesn't listen to this, so it's fine.
Hey, Matt and Andrew!
Yeah. Andrew might listen to this. It's the sort of thing he would do and then not tell me.
Oh.
Whereas Matt would just be like, no... This is your weird Russian film podcast.
Well, I haven't listened to any episodes yet.
Harsh.
Oh,
well, neither have I.
Well, I listen. Well, I already hear half the conversation anyway.
Yeah, fair enough.
Why do I need to listen to this again?
You get behind the scenes.
Exactly.
But I'd like to think that the other half is the interesting half of the conversation, not my half.
Well, you can kind of figure out what's going on based off of what's happening. So it's just...
Fair enough. That's a ringing endorsement, but anyway.
I'm basically saying I've already listened to it.
Yeah, fair. All right. I'll stop giving you a hard time. Yeah, anyway, just probably watch this thing.
Yeah, let's get onto it. Let's get amongst it.
Yes.
I've been watching too much the Danny Dyer history thing.
Oh, okay.
It's really good. It's really random.
I haven't seen any of it. It does sound like it would be random.
It's fun. Okay. Sorry, anyway, you can edit that bit out.
Okay. So, yeah, do you remember from last time what we say?
Not the word. I remember there is a word.
Okay.
And it's fun to say, but I don't remember
cool.
what the word is.
Well, Carrie, could you introduce the word?
So the word is basically let's go in Russian. And it's поехали.
Поехали.
Yes.
All right. And why is it a thing?
That's what Yuri Gagarin said before they blasted him off into space.
Oh, yes. Wow. Okay.
So as we launch into the film, I wanted to, do a little Russian cultural reference.
Nice. Clever. I like it.
Yeah. I'm sure long-time listeners are like, we heard you say this like 30-plus times. But anyway, never mind. Okay, so 3, 2, 1.
Broccoli! Sorry. I'm never being asked back. I'm not drunk, I promise.
We did have
unless
breakfast.
You did put something in that sangria.
Well, aside from the champagne, no.
Prosecco, Carrie, come on.
That's true, it was Prosecco.
Yeah, you don't want the listeners to think we're too decadent.
No, we just had Prosecco for breakfast.
Oh, I'm just making so much money off this podcast that it's just all champagne and caviar.
No, I don't think you've made anything off of this podcast.
No, probably not.
Anyway.
Anyway, yes.
Not even HelloFresh. They advertise on everyone's.
Nope.
Well, now you're making me feel really bad.
Not MeUndies, not Casper, not...
Squarespace.
Squarespace. None of them.
Yeah.
None of them at all.
It's still time. We've Salt. Just given them a shout out, so they'll send a box, I'm sure.
That's how it works. If you mention them, they're legally obliged to send you some random goodies.
Should we try again? I won't be silly.
I don't trust you now.
I've forgotten what it is now, so I'm just going to listen. I'm
like,
you do it. Okay.
Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Payekali!
Hello.
So, Jenny, Carrie, and I have just watched Onegin, aka One Gin.
Which was one gin too many than I should have had. It was actually, I have to say, when I had the breakfast sangria, which I presumed was non-alcoholic, listeners, had a little bit of Prosecco in, so...
Well, we just like to oil the wheels around here. As previous listeners will be aware on occasion.
So, aside from our penchant to have a drink with our meal...
Breakfast as well.
Yeah.
It was brunch. You're
That's
allowed to
fine.
Have a drink at brunch.
That is fine, actually. Yeah.
Brunch covers a multitude of sins. Anyway, you probably don't want to hear this, listeners. You probably want to hear what we thought about the movie. But before we get on to our thoughts, just a quick... overview of the plot from Jenny. So if you don't want to know what happens, this is the time to pause the podcast, watch the movie, and then come back.
Because there will be spoilers since it's based off of a 200-year-old book. So there's that.
Yeah, but not everyone's got round to reading everything.
True, but this isn't like a movie that just came out and
It's not like we've had access to the Game of Thrones script and we're about to, like, divulge it for the whole world to hear.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to tell anyone about that.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I told George R. R. Martin we could be trusted.
We'll cut that one out in post.
All right.
So, yeah, my plot summary, basically, let me just clarify how to pronounce his name once more.
Yevgeny Onyegin.
Onyegin. Onyegin. Okay, Onyegin. So, Onyegin inherits his uncle's mansion in the country. He pops along there and meets the neighbours. They have two pretty, very charming daughters. One is already engaged to his friend, a guy called, oh, I can't remember, Vladimir something, played by Toby Stevens. And she is Olga, played by Lena Headey, as we noticed. Another Game of Thrones reference.
Cersei, yeah.
Exactly. Very different role, though. And the other daughter is a sort of muse-like Liv Tyler. She is called Tatiana. And she falls for Onyegin and writes him a letter declaring her love. He rather patronisingly tells her she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's very young and impressionable and she'll get over it, basically.
Oh, goodness me, it was very patronising.
Wasn't it? Oh, yeah. And it was on her birthday as well. Poor girl.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's very sort of deep. And she was very hurt by this. And so then that happens. And then also, Onyegin sort of upsets the apple cart again by dancing with Olga, Cersei. And Toby Stevens is very upset about this. Challenges him to a duel in true poet style. Obviously, Toby Stevens gets shot. Well done. So now everyone's all very upset. And he sort of leaves. Fast forward 6 years. Tatiana has married very well, and Onyegin has decided he does love her after all, but it's too late.
Excellent. That was a great summary. It condensed a lot of stuff into, very
good.
Short, concise, and now I'm waffling.
I felt like I wasn't concise. There was a bit of ums and ahs there, but yeah.
No, that covers all the major plot points, but yeah, it was fairly faithful to the books and the book's plot. It follows the major arcs. It follows the major character developments.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things that it condenses and shortens. For example, it has the conversation between Yevgeny and Tatiana about the letter that Tatiana wrote happening the same day as her birthday.
Mm.
In the book, those are two completely separate events.
Okay.
And he gives her the sermon. And it's really a sermon telling her why she doesn't actually love him and why he's right and she's wrong. And then the dance is a completely different thing and it's a different thing happening. So, it's a movie, they have to condense. But the big thing they left out was there's this weird dream sequence kind of in the middle of the book that Tatiana has while she's in love with Onyegin. And it's supposed to be like, her dreams are telling her future and what's going to happen and what her fate is going to be.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot about fate, wasn't there?
Yeah, and that's completely out of the book. Or not the book, the movie.
Yeah, because there's sort of like animals and like animal monster creatures. And it's really this is an anachronistic word to use, but quite surreal.
Mm-hmm. Is it almost like his drawings? Because we had that in the movie. Ralph Fiennes' character kind of draws lots of these crazy, slightly surreal, inky drawings that she sees and looks at, and she's like, is this what Petersburg's really like? You know, city life. And it seemed kind of monstrous.
It's even worse than that, because it's like real character, but it'd be like a real bear.
Okay.
Like, sit and foxes and wolves and whatnot sitting around a table eating dinner.
Oh, crazy.
Like, they were high society people, and Megan is there with them.
I remember one drawing had a woman as like a bird's beak sort of thing. Maybe it was a bit like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's super weird. I've read Onyegin quite recently, but I must admit, not a lot stuck with me.
Yeah.
But that dream sequence is very strange, and she like foresees Lenski's death at the hands of Onyegin. I mean, it's not like, it's not super spelled out. It's like a knife and,
some doom.
Yeah, and it's quite surprising in a way that they left it out because it...
It sounds quite key, yeah.
But I can see why that would be hard to film.
It might look a bit stupid, a bit comedy.
Yeah.
Because it's a very serious, brooding film.
Yeah.
Bears eating dinner might look a bit jarring, potentially, if they did it wrong.
Yeah, I can see in 19...
It'd be difficult and expensive to do, and you wouldn't have had the CGI at that point to be able to do it right. So I can see why they might have...
Maybe there wasn't a fine sibling that was a CGI specialist. So.
Yes.
I can see why what they did have as far as reading the fate thing was their old nanny, Olga and Tatiana's nanny, spilling wax into a bowl of water, and then she'd read the wax to see what was going to happen in their futures and who they were going to marry.
I mean, so we've all done it.
Oh, yeah. So playing MASH on the school bus on the way home.
You have to explain that one.
Yeah, MASH. What's MASH?
That's an American thing?
Yeah.
Oh, so it's like who you're going to marry, what kind of house, H is for what kind of house you're going to live in, S is for, I don't know, one of them is job, and the other is how many kids you're going to have or something.
Okay. Oh, wow. But how does it work?
I don't even remember. I just distinctly remember doing this. It was like you pick a number and you cross different options off, and it's three that you'd like and one that you'd hate.
Okay.
So you're like, you know, you live in a mansion, that's what it is. A mansion, apartment, a shack, or a house. That's what MASH stands for. So it's you're like, which are you going to live in?
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to be when you grow up and all this other stuff.
Okay.
The only thing I remember was vaguely similar to that was like a Coke can, and you did the, after you'd sort of flick the thing, you do the alphabet.
So like a ring pull.
Yes. Yeah. So after you'd flick the ring pull, you'd go A, B, C, D, and then the number it broke off at was going to be the surname of the guy you married.
Really? Well, this is obviously one that completely passed me by as a young man growing up in secondary school.
Obviously, much more sensible than us silly girls.
That's not what I meant.
But sounds bad, though, doesn't it? Like, that's what we did.
Yeah.
It's just how the whole, you must have a man, you must be in a relationship thing was bad for us even when we were kids. And then this is 200 years ago. The movie was 200 years ago. The book was 200 years ago. Then it was like, if you're a woman, you must be married.
Well, that was very strongly spelled out, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
In almost like, was it a different old lady that was dying in the bed and she was saying, oh, she must marry?
I don't think she was actually dying. I just think she was...
Just lazy.
She was elderly and rich, and she was basically like, well, my poor cousins are coming to visit me, and I don't feel like getting out of bed, just so they can come visit me while I am in bed.
I quite liked her. She was a very sort of minor character, but yeah, she basically spelled out, she must make a good match. She has one season to impress the right man, otherwise
she'll be washed up. They only have the money for one season.
That's right, yeah.
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 And she has this kind of visor for reading.
Yes, I wondered what that was.
Yeah. Oh, I assume that's what it was, like, for shading her eyes.
Yeah. But it was basically she has one winner of balls and whatnot to meet somebody who wants to marry her, or else she's going to be either a spinster or a courtesan.
Those are the two things.
Those are your only options.
And they're presented like they're equally bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Yevgeny's not married at all, doesn't get married, no intentions of getting married. And there's no pressure, no one cares. It's okay. But there's another princess in the story who's like 30 and is completely washed up.
Oh, yeah.
How terrible.
Disgrace. Yeah. On the shelf.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is very strong on that like element of what society was like. I mean, I don't remember the book as well as that. I mean, certainly...
The book still shows that. I mean, and with something like that coming, I don't think it's quite as...
On the nose?
No, it's not quite as on the nose, and it's a little bit less sarcastically critical than we were just now. But it is very much pointing out that it's like, poor Tatiana, she's being forced into having to marry someone she doesn't love, and when she doesn't want to get married. And it is pointing out that, like, no one's pressure, no one is, and no one ever has said that Onyegin has to get married. And at one point he specifically says, I'm not made for marriage. I'm not going to get married. Like,
there's no motivation for him to get married.
Yeah, there's no need to.
But for them, it's financial security. You know, they sort of said love is a luxury. They were quite mocking of the idea that she wants to marry for love. I guess one thing is that they might maybe have to spell that out a bit more for modern viewers on a film, whereas the book, written in that contemporary time, everyone would have just known that that was so. So it wouldn't be having to be spelled out, because that's how everybody knew that life was, whereas obviously it's not like that now, so they maybe have to make more of that in the film.
Yeah. At the same time, I felt like the film wasn't spelling everything out, like,
no,
you, audience, you're dumb and don't know anything about anything, so we're just going to explain everything about this time period in a very clunky way, because we just don't give you enough credit to figure things out.
No, it was quite subtly done. It wasn't too clunky.
Yeah.
Did you like it? What did everybody think about it?
Ooh. I did, with a certain amount of reservation. How about...
I liked the book better than the movie.
Okay.
Which I realise is such a cliche thing to say, but it's
just so learned, Curry.
Well, no, it's just the book has all kinds of small details in it that, of course, you have to leave out in a movie. You don't, like, it's an hour 45 or something like that. You don't have a lot to play with here. And if they had made it any longer, we would have been like, good God, it keeps dragging, just, like, cut it down. But the beauty of the book is the fact that it's poetry, and in the way it's written, and in the visual image, the image is that he paints with the way he writes. And it's a different medium from film. And I think the way the film is shot, it's very much trying to be atmospheric and having beautiful shots and doing things in that way. And the costuming is definitely, like, gorgeous. But it's just... I've read the book first. I liked the book first. And I think I'm going to stick with what I liked first.
Yeah.
It's not that it's a bad movie. I just...
It's fairly highly reasonable, really. I mean, that's often the case, isn't it, with a book? You get more of the character's introspection, and you kind of hear what they're thinking and understand more of it, because it's, you get deeper into it. I suppose the film could just be a sort of very quick representation of all that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got more time with the book for stuff to build, I suppose.
And you spend more time with the book, don't you? You might read it over a month or whatever, whereas a film, it only really impacts your life for couple of hours or something. Was maybe something in that.
Yeah, although it's possibly more concentrated in that, you know, everything is imagined for you and right in front of you.
Yeah, true.
Like, I've kind of embarrassed to admit this, but, like, I did read the book, and it just, like, I didn't really take it in particularly. Like, it didn't leave a very strong impression. I'm kind of having to go back to things and go, oh yeah, okay, was that how it happened? So it may have just been I wasn't reading it at a point where I had lots of mental energy to give to processing it. One thing that did strike me was, I feel like the film was slightly more sympathetic to Onegin than the movie is. I mean, the movie...
Okay. And what, the book was more...
Was less sympathetic.
Ah. I didn't get that impression.
Oh, okay. No, I felt like the book was a bit like, oh, well, he's a bit of a fop. I mean, there is some of that in...
Yeah, for me, watching it, he didn't seem very, very sympathetic at all. He was very sort of, I guess, aloof and quite unfeeling, not very good at... Well, he didn't really care about other people. He reminded me a bit of the character he plays in The Duchess, Duke of Devonshire, where he's obviously, you know, very sort of high and mighty and really just kind of does his own thing regardless. Again, it's that sort of aristocratic Ralph Fiennes sort of character.
Yeah, because he's a very, very good actor, but there's kind of like, when he's not doing something that's different, it's kind of like a almost like revert to Ralph Fiennes' aloof performance.
Yeah, he's never lovable, is he? He's never cuddly and jolly.
No, but on the other hand, like, when, I don't know if you've seen Schindler's List.
Yeah.
He's like absolutely terrifying in that. But it's like terrifying.
He's a good villain.
Yeah, good.
Whereas this one is more sneery.
Yeah, and that's... I feel like there's more films that I've seen him when he's doing that more kind of sneery thing. I don't know if you've seen In Bruges.
Oh, yes, yeah,
because he's very different. He's like shouty and angry and like...
Mm-hmm. Again, unsympathetic though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in the book, there's a... I think that... Just to clarify, I think Fiennes does an excellent job of playing Onegin, and that is definitely the way Onegin is read in the book, and the way that the character comes off. But there's a certain amount... The narrator in the book kind of feels sympathy for Onyegin or has pity on him.
Okay.
And I think he's trying to make a statement that, look, you know, St. Petersburg society is totally vapid and unbearable, and Onyegin just kind of reacts to it in this way, and it's, these are the types of people that we're churning out and creating because this is the way that we've structured society.
Mm. There was a bit of a town and country theme, wasn't there?
Very much so. Like, there's this whole bit where Lienski and Onyegin have a bit of an altercation prior to the duel, where...
Yes, about one of them being one of the sisters that he's into, that the poet guy's into,
Olga.
Being a bit provincial.
Yeah, and he, Lienski, like, literally says, you think she's provincial, don't you? And he's like, yes, actually.
And so do you, actually, if you think about it, yeah.
And you also are provincial.
Yeah.
As opposed to me, the slick city sophisticate.
Yes, and the mum was talking about sort of like, and I think the tutor as well, you know, if they're to make it in society, they have to be sort of civilised and sophisticated to and sort of shake off their provincial roots and that sort of an old-fashioned sort of thing. But then there's also that feeling that actually they were having quite a nice time in the country. It was quite old-fashioned, but everyone seemed quite happy. And it was summer there. I noticed that they set it was all sort of mostly in summer. And then in Petersburg, it was all winter and harsh and cold, and all the people were kind of the same.
Yeah, yeah. Although the mother, she makes a comment where you feel like actually she misses the city life, and she ended up just out in kind of like the sticks.
That's right, through marriage.
Yeah.
She said, you came here to the country by choice, whereas she ended up here because she'd obviously married a country lord or whatever.
Yeah,
and so maybe she was...
Yeah, this was the best match she could make, so yeah, she just had to go with it.
Yeah. Actually, I felt like the first maybe 30 minutes, three quarters of an hour, there's quite a lot of funny, sarky kind of humour.
The two guys have a good sort of bit of back and forth. Onyegin and the...
Lienski,
yeah.
Yeah.
He's quite funny.
Toby Stevens' character, yeah.
Yeah, he adds a bit of... Not humour exactly, but something a bit light. You can sort of laugh at him a bit.
Yeah, it gives Onyegin something to react to, I feel.
He's a bit of a vessel for that.
Yeah, although he is super patronising to him as well.
Yeah. But
it's weird, though, because, like, when you see the couple of scenes early on of Onyegin in St. Petersburg, he's very foppish and kind of snooty. And then there's these couple of guys who are, like, archetypal fops.
Yeah, they're, like, sort of Prince George, Blackadder style, sort of really daft, rouged up and sort of lolling in their chairs and talking all ridiculous stuff about ballerinas and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're being really gross. And the way that, I don't know, this is, I think, what I meant about it being sympathetic to Onyegin. You get...
He's not exactly one of them.
No,
he's
but
a bit apart from that.
At the same time, he's kind of playing along. But from what you were saying, Carrie, your memory of the book is that the narrator is a bit more, like, sympathetic to Onyegin and the way he's turned out than I maybe thought.
This is just going from memory. I remember the narrator as kind of liking Onyegin.
Okay.
In a way, like, even though he's not a good guy, there's something about the narrator that likes him.
Okay.
So it's kind of, if the narrator is Pushkin, and you can't always say that because you don't know, but there's something about the character Onyegin as Pushkin has written him that appeals to Pushkin.
That could have maybe changed the film a little if he had been a bit more sympathetic, because I'm trying to think of things that you would like about the guy. You know, he's privileged and he's rude and he's aloof and he's kind of... Yeah, there's not much to like.
No, I didn't like him either as I'm reading the book, but there's just not this sense of I will deal with Onyegin harshly in the same way that, say, that French tutor is. That French tutor is clearly ridiculous and awful and...
Oh, yeah.
In a number of different ways. Yeah, buffoonish, that's a good word for it. Whereas you don't quite get the same harshness when he's writing about Onyegin.
I feel like he could have had something, just something for us to kind of
Well, he's
make
well,
him read for him.
He's well read because he's clearly like when Tatiana comes to borrow a book.
I think that's maybe
like
I'm just
it's like
reading.
Oh, do you like this one? Well, I found this. Oh, well maybe this one. Oh, well, so he's clearly read a lot, and
yeah.
in the book also he's very well read.
He's very really intelligent.
He has that artistic talent because he's drawing caricatures of people. He draws a sketch of Tatiana in the movie. Mm. So it's like he has talents. He just doesn't have anything. He has no inclination to do anything.
He has no purpose, really, does he?
Yeah, it's just like, I am waiting for my uncle to die so that I have a lot of money, and now I have a lot of money, and
One thing, actually, which I think is what maybe Tatiana first is attracted by, is that when they're chatting over the dinner table, when he's just moved to the country and inherited this, they ask what he plans to do with this mansion he's just acquired, and he says, well, I'll rent it out. And they say, well, to whom? Who's going to farm it? And
there's,
he says...
Basically, there's no, the implication being, there's no one around here to rent it to.
Yeah.
You know, we're the only family with, you know, two coins to rub together.
Yeah, and they're so baffled. And he says, well, the serfs, they'll run it. And is that right? He says,
yeah, absolutely.
The farmers, I guess, will run it. And they're like, wow, that's bizarre. That's very radical. And he seems to have quite progressive views. And then Tatiana, sort of, I think the first line she actually says, because she's introduced very as a quiet character, and she's sort of this ephemeral kind of quality to her. And then I think her first line is something about, why should one human own another due to an accident of birth? And then it's like, ah, oh, my dear, she has very strange views, pass the wine or something, you know, like dismissively. So they seem to have a similar understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's possibly what one of the things that Tatiana sees in him, because there is a certain amount of like, why does she like him?
Yeah, and maybe it is, you know, what one thing he says is that she's just sort of almost projected her romantic feelings onto this guy that's wandered into her life. It could have been anyone.
Mm.
And you think, well, I mean, even though he says it in such a patronising and sort of I know everything sort of way, he could be right in that sense. You know, she's a young girl and she doesn't obviously know a lot of people living out there. And then some sort of handsome stranger walks in. Maybe he's like, oh, well, you know, she's just chosen me. I could have been anyone, really, that walked in. But, yeah.
Well, you do, with the way they introduce Tatiana and the way they shoot her, you do get the feeling that she's that very mysterious, dreamy, and there's also a dreamlike quality to her. Because at first when she's shot, you see her through a window, and then you see her through another window, and then it's through a doorway, and then there's like a bookshelf, and it's through the bookshelf, and then
like she's apart from something.
Mm. Exactly. There's constantly something between you and Tatiana, except for the end, after she gets married to the other guy.
Well, she's then unattainable as well, which kind of buys into the next bit, when he does finally realise that he wants her, she is unattainable. She's this sort of like, I guess,
Yeah, there's always something between them. There's always this dreamlike thing with her and the way her character is throughout it.
Yeah.
She's
almost like otherworldly, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas her sister is very much rooted in the here and now. And I think once her fiancé has been shot in the duel, you know, she's obviously upset. But then she quickly gets over it and marries someone else. And the mother goes, oh, she's always been very practical.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of, I think, Tatiana is very dreamy and romantic,
and she's still cut up about the way she used to feel about Anyegin 6 years on, because when he comes and declares his like undying love to her, she's really 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 upset.
Yeah, she feels it very deeply, and she's crying, and she's saying, you know, obviously she still feels for him, but now she's married to someone else and she's sworn to be faithful, and she just tells him it's too late. So, yeah, it's very much tables have turned in this scenario, and I'm pretty sure he uses some of her words there.
Mm.
He sort of... no, she says to him, what do you think you see?
Yes.
Whereas he'd said that to her, as in, like, what does she think he is? Maybe she's just imagining what she wants to imagine. It's the same with him. He's kind of imagining this creature that he wants to obtain. Like, does he actually want her, or is it just the idea of her?
Well, in the conquest, I think she might use the word, like, you basically want to sleep with me, and then you'll...
win, almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, it's not about that. And
she also says, is it now that I'm noble that you want me?
Mm.
And now I'm worthy of you, almost.
Yeah, because one thing I don't think we mentioned is that the guy Tatiana marries...
is a very rich, very well-connected, very high birth aristocracy.
Yeah.
Like, she is the unofficial ice queen of St. Petersburg society.
Nice, good description of that.
Well, and that comes out in the way that that room is decorated.
Yes. Very stylized. She's this sort of, on almost like an ice throne, and she's all in white, and this sort of wind sort of blow, it sounds like this chilly wind kind of blowing around, and it just looks like the most icy palace you've ever seen.
Yeah,
there is, and why you would sit in a room like that's all cold marble and no fire or anything in a St. Petersburg winter.
She'll catch a chill.
Beyond me.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
It was clearly done for movie reasons, not practicality.
And they use white to sort of describe her quite often, don't they? When she writes this letter in this sort of feverish passion, she writes this letter to him, and she's in this white gown, and then the ink is all over her hands. And then she sort of rubs it off on her dress, with not a thought for the maids trying to get that stain out.
Yeah, that's privilege.
Yeah, totally.
The actual privilege there, isn't it? Yeah,
like Lizzie in her muddy petticoats.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a thought for the servants.
Yeah. Well, and I noticed very much like the scratchiness.
Yes.
It's
almost uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, you normally don't get that when you see somebody writing with a quill pen. Sometimes you get it, but it's not... Like, this felt like it was really brought forward in the mix, and it's really emphasised how scratchy and passionate she's crossing things out.
Yeah.
Like, you see her write the word love, and then, like...
Yeah.
But then later she does writes it and leaves it. She doesn't cross it out.
The white sort of, obviously, virginal dress being damaged by this black ink and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah. So you could quite easily make the fun of this movie as melodramatic, but I think with...
You can read the book that way, so you could read it as it being faithful to the book in that sense. Because the book was written kind of in the classical style.
Well, post-romantic.
Yeah, post-romantic, so it would still have a lot of that influence in it.
Yeah, although the narrator has a very biting, sarcastic voice.
Okay, that's something you lose in a film instantly, isn't
Absolutely.
It? The narrative voice.
Yeah, yeah, because the narrator... In the book, at least as I remember, which, you know, disclaimers, I've already said, I don't remember it very well. It's like the narrator is more of a fleshed out character almost than Anya Egan himself is.
Mm-hmm.
But also, again, going back to the sympathy thing, I think the narrator in the book likes Tatiana more than he likes Anya Egan. And I feel like the film has a similar attitude.
She's presented very sympathetically, I think.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to make fun of her, I don't think.
Well, I think one of the readings that people have had about the book is that Tatiana represents Russia in the way that Russia should be.
Oh.
In the way, you know, loves the country, believes in fate and the traditional Russian superstitions. Like the whole thing with the dream, and she has this book where it's how to interpret dreams and how that being traditional. And in the movie it tries to do it with like the whole candle wax and the traditional, what does my nanny say? And like, and Tatiana is like actually believing it, whereas her sister's like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
You always just say we'll marry soldiers.
Even the hairstyles, actually. She has a very sort of provincial...
The braid around her head, like everything that Tatiana does, is like she is Russia and she is pristine and she's
pure.
Great. And it's only after she comes to St. Petersburg.
Well, then she's in this bright scarlet gown with this huge sort of updo, and she's obviously changed, and her character's slightly different as well. She's got a bit of fire and
yeah. So it's very, very sympathetic to Tatiana. But at the same time, it doesn't criticize the decision Tatiana had to make.
No.
It's very much just like, well... Poor Tatiana.
It was
like,
that record
this is life.
Yeah.
At the time, so.
Yeah, it's like she's very in touch with her feelings and her intuition, but at the same time, it's not like all emotion, no intellect, because she is like, you see her going to seek out books.
Mm.
You know, and that's the, like we've already said, one of the things where she has, bond is the wrong word with Anya Egan, but
well,
that's something where they
bond.
Do connect a little bit.
Yes, they're interested in learning and sort of looking beyond their immediate world around them, potentially.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Hmm.
Huh.
That hasn't flowed onto another topic quite easily.
Yeah.
What about other sort of themes? I mean, the sort of town and country thing, the theme of love or the theme of fate, I thought kind of popped up quite a lot.
Yes.
And you said that was quite a Russian thing, which is sort of interesting to me.
I think, yeah, I mean, we kind of made fun of it more as university students than we should have, but the whole idea of fate in Russian literature or Russian society seemed to come up a little bit more than, and people believing in it a little bit more than in the States. And that in the States, there's a bit more of a pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you make your own luck sort of a deal.
Yep.
And people believe that a little bit more than in Russia, where it's a bit more of, well, this is kind of just the way it is, and this is the hand that you've been dealt, and now you have to play it.
That's interesting.
And I'm not sure that either view is 100% correct. It's probably somewhere in the middle.
How balanced. sorry, I was mean.
Well, and I don't want to make it seem like the States and the Russia, you know, everyone believes one thing and the other, they believe the other. Yeah, so it's also a bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah, but there definitely, it seems to me that there are, like, cultural tendencies, and yeah, mm-hmm. being kind of fatalistic is a bit more of a Russian thing. I mean, it does come up in titles quite a bit, like there's Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate. Mm-hmm. That's a big one.
But the two countries do also have a very different history.
Yeah, of course.
And track. So, yeah, I don't want to make it sound like, Russians should clearly just, you know, snap out of it. When you look at the country's history.
Cheer up, dudes.
Yeah. it kind of makes a lot of sense why things have developed the way that they have.
Yeah.
I wonder where we sit in the UK in terms of whether it's like make your own luck or, you know, this is the way it's always been sort of sentiment.
I think we're possibly more to the, like, Russian pessimism kind of, like, stuff sucks and what can you do about it?
I think that comes from being an older country. It's almost like you're an older person with sort of the cynicism and the sort of the world weariness almost, like, that you don't get in maybe, again, this is hugely general, but there's sort of, like, even Australia and America, everything seems a bit more vibrant and a bit more optimistic.
Well, also, I think having, like, an embedded aristocracy...
Yes.
I mean, not that, you know, everyone who's in charge of anything is an aristocrat here in the modern times, but it certainly does help if you kind of have...
Yeah, well, even now,
we're
built on that foundation. You know, only 100 years ago, that would have been very much the case. So, yeah, we're still trying to sort of shake that off, I guess. And that hasn't been the case in younger countries where they've sort of formed themselves...
Yeah, or maybe that, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, money talks everywhere, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, here it seems
But it's how you acquire that money. You know, fate gives you money if you're born to it.
Yeah.
You know, you've acquired that by an accident of birth. That wasn't how you acquired it. You didn't acquire it because you made it.
There's some duke of something or other who's the godfather of one of Will's and Kate's kids, and it's like... money is inherited all the way back from 1066 conquest. And, like, you can trace it back, and that's why he's one of the richest people in the UK today.
Yep.
It's like, it's not that somebody invented something, somebody...
And if they had, you know, new money would be very frowned upon if you'd made your own money 100 years ago.
But the fact that it's, like, 1,000 years, and you can trace it back 1,000 years.
Yeah, that's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm glad you didn't say anything treasonous about the monarchy there.
Well, I did call them Wills and Kate instead of referring to them with any titles or anything.
I'm not going to be cast out for that.
Yeah.
Well, I've learned to try to not completely tank Ellie's podcast and alienate any potential audience that he could have. So.
Yeah, and we do have a very big monarchist following.
Maybe Wills and Kate listen, who knows?
I'm sure they do. Did you like the performances, the acting?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's anything that jarred or seemed odd. Everyone did quite a good job, yeah.
It took me a little while to, like, maybe warm to is the wrong word, but... Toby Stevens, I'm so used to seeing him as, like, a snarling cad, to seeing him as this kind of, like, fairly, how would you even say it, not very self-confident, slightly anxious guy. That was unusual seeing him.
But again, he did have something that I've seen him play quite often, that sort of slightly, it's really hard to put your finger on, actually, that it's quite a sort of laughable quality he tends to bring, where he's quite all over the place and sort of lovably foolish kind of thing, I think, came through.
Okay, I'm trying to think what else.
Like, gets things wrong a lot, and it's... Yeah. But in a sort of sneering, sort of upper-class sort of way as well.
Yeah. As I mainly remember him from that one Bond film that he did, and then also, I think he was Orsino in, like, Twelfth Night, which is very similar, and in that one he's very, kind of, he's very ruling the roost. Yeah.
I thought, like, Lena Headey, I thought, did a good job. I have no criticism of her acting in this, but she just... her physically and the way Olga's described in the book are a complete mismatch.
Yeah.
Because in the book she's described as being blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and at the time, you know, the a bit more of, like, the plump, round figure was more of, like, she's the ideal Russian beauty is what she's supposed to be. And Lena Headey is beautiful. Don't anyone write in and say, how dare you think that Lena Headey is anything less than beautiful, because I don't. She's just not the way I picture the character when I read it.
Yeah, interesting.
And, like, she's supposed to be miles more beautiful than Tatiana.
Tatiana, well, Liv Tyler was, you know, she's the picture of, like, you know, ephemeral beauty. She seems like the pretty sister, but I think it's obviously meant to be the other way around.
Yeah, it's definitely meant to be the other way around.
I've totally forgotten that. Forgotten that from the
Did
book.
Did you really read the book, Ali?
Because it makes a big deal about, it's like, oh, well, of course Linsky fell in love with Olga. She's the hot one.
Yeah.
As opposed to the dreamy, you know, kind of romantic, but, you know, she's cute, but...
But they kind of do that with Pride and Prejudice, I think. Because in the book, obviously Jane's meant to be the beauty of the family. Mm. But in the film, like, Lizzie's really hot. And you think she's meant to be the sort of... in Jane's shadow a little bit, and a bit like the quirky one.
Oh, are we talking about, like, the...
The series, the... yeah.
Oh, the series,
The famous mini-series with the lake jumping scene and Colin Firth.
I've heard of it. I've heard of it. Yeah. I've heard it's a thing that people watch. No, I was just going to say...
Your wife watches it, like, what, every 3 months?
Something like that.
Oh. It's not quite that often.
Yeah, okay.
Well, even in the Joe Wright one, I mean, what's her name? Keira Knightley is obviously a beautiful actress playing Lizzie. She's maybe a bit too pretty for the part as well.
Yes. Well, that's what I assumed you were referring to. Because don't get me wrong, Jennifer Ehle is nice to look at. But, yeah.
I'd go for her over Jane in that one, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. How do I even answer that?
But in front of your wife.
Maybe it's just preference then.
Yeah. awkward. This makes me sad that, like, Liv Tyler isn't in more stuff, and not just because she's attractive.
Yeah, she did such a good job, actually. I thought she's really, like, presented the character really well.
Mm, and she's given a lot to do.
Yes. One thing I noticed about her character is that she makes everything very tactile. Mm. There's a lot of her sort of reading things or seeing things with her hands. Like, she touches the way she picks up the papers that he's drawn, and even the books, and the way she's... I know a lot of the scenes she's in, she's sort of feeling things. And I thought that was quite cool. She did a lot of hand acting.
Yeah, she's grounded and down to earth.
Whilst at the same time having that kind of, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, because we've used, like, ethereal quite a lot.
Yes, I thought she was very otherworldly.
She was otherworldly, but she's otherworldly but still connected to the land and the country that she's in.
I guess as well, that just, she's quite... I don't know how you would...
Well, I think
what that's to convey.
I think you've already said tactile.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I noticed a thing yesterday. I was doing a little bit of pre-reading and found out that the Russian Critics Guild gave her an award for best performance by an actress in a foreign film, which is quite a compliment, because just taking on this really important work of Russian literature kind of invites... critics to be sniffy. So the fact that Russian critics went, yeah, she does a good job.
A good endorsement then.
So that was something that quite impressed me. So.
I was just thinking, I mean, again, about Lena Headey. We obviously mentioned that, but she plays a very different role, and that's a kind of endorsement of her acting abilities. You know, she's in this, we took a while to actually recognise her. Obviously, you knew who it was. And
yeah.
He was sort of saying, do you recognise her? Just sort of to see whether I could. And then you go, oh, wow, it is. And she's sort of very, almost kind of like nerdy, sort of quite a bit awkward and silly and sort of not at all regal and evil and all the rest of the things Cersei is.
Yes.
She's supposed to be a light, silly, kind of slightly thoughtless flirt.
Yes, a bit not with the complete lack of that depth that her sister has.
Yeah, like we've already mentioned, she moves on very quickly after her, you know, intended gets his brains blown out.
Yeah, which was always going to happen. You just think, oh God, here we go. And he's sort of nervously raising the pistol and we think, oh, I know how this is going to end.
That was well played. That was a very...
It's an amazingly atmospheric scene. Because they did
the
it...
The duel, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
On the jetty with the sort of mist and the... Yeah. Windmill. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. And I think we've already said this as well, but it is a very impressive film to look at, both in terms of the costumes, but also of the sets and the locations.
I think that was the scene that they probably changed from the characterization from the book the most, in that I don't remember Onegin trying to stop the duel in the book as much as he does in the movie. Because in the movie, he goes up to Lensky like 3 times. He's like, really? Do we have to? Are you sure?
Yeah.
Like, come on.
That makes
sense. We
don't
have to do this.
A bit more sympathetic
like,
as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it totally does. Because in the movie, it's very much like, this is ridiculous. Like, come on. There's no point in doing this. And it's Lensky who's like, no, we have to duel. Whereas I think...
Honor demands it.
Yeah.
Yeah. My, you know, you've offended Olga's honor. Whereas...
Olga doesn't give a shit. She's just waiting for him to come back home, and he's not gonna, because he's got his brains blown out.
Yeah.
Well done.
Whereas in the book, I think it's just like, okay, well, he's, you know, you've talked him into a duel, and so I'll go out and we'll have the duel, and, you know, then that's the duel, and that's it.
Is he very upset about it in the book?
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly torn apart, but he also... It goes on into his travels a bit more and about how it's this whirlwind of him just going here, there, and everywhere and not being happy anywhere he goes because of what he's just done and what has just happened.
The time lapse was difficult to process because 6 years had obviously passed and he was clearly back in society, and I thought he was referring to the fact that he'd just been in the country and that was him travelling, but he obviously had been travelling and been tormented and restless, but that didn't... I guess they had to... smash those two bits together and didn't have time to really go into any of that.
Yeah.
Could have been a nice little montage sequence, that. They didn't even have a montage. Even Rocky had a montage.
Yes. It's a very famous cinema montage. Him just randomly turning up in Turkey.
Him on a train sort of staring broodily out the window as the countryside.
Oh, no, that would have been very anachronistic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, not a train. Yeah,
not
trains. What am I talking about?
No. Trains, I don't know.
He could have been on a ship.
Well, actually, a train wouldn't have been this far afterwards, because this was sort of 1828. I think young Queen Victoria in the 1830s, 40s was riding on a little train with Prince Albert.
Yeah, maybe.
So just being invented.
Yeah, and I think Britain was a little bit further ahead as far as trains
and stuff was concerned.
But he could have been on, like, some boat.
He could have been, yes.
Sailing by or down rivers or whatever.
In fact, I was going to mention the opening, which, as with a lot of historical adaptations, began with a sleigh. Well, this in this instance, it was a sled ride. But often, you see, I find anyway, that these films start with a carriage ride. Like, the character is going somewhere, something's changing. And he was in this sort of black kind of enclosed... It looked like a carriage, but it was going over the snow in a very Russian way. So you immediately know, aha, we're in Russia here, and there's Russian music, and there's ice skating immediately, and there's a few films, I think, where they start off with the character in a carriage heading towards their story.
Yeah. Oh, and birch trees, of course, because that's important when you're signalling to people that they're in Russia.
Birch trees, really?
Birch trees, yeah. It's like
they will have whole forests that are just birch.
See, birch trees here, we get rid of on our reserve because they're non-native, sort of invasive, and we should have sort of oak forest. But lots of birch trees sort of take over quite quickly.
Well,
so is that
they
the
spring
native...
up very quickly,
Birch
trees is almost like the iconic Russian tree.
Oh, that's interesting. I think they're gorgeous. I feel really sad when they chop them down and say, oh no, we need to have different trees for the birds or whatever. But yeah, I like a birch tree. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah.
But Russia does have it. I think in colder regions, you do get that more, where you'll have like one forest where it is all of X tree.
Wow.
And it is only X tree.
But is that because it's been planted in such a way?
There is a bit more, like, when you get to colder regions, if there's some scientists listening and I'm wrong, please correct me, but I think in colder regions you do get more of, you get less biodiversity, so fewer species, but more of each of those species, whereas then you get to the rainforest, you might only have, like, you have thousands and thousands and thousands of different species, yeah. but, you know, only a few of each.
Hmm.
So I think it just depends on where are you in that climate belt.
Yeah.
Because I used to sometimes get asked by Russians, like, what types of forests do you have in the States? I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I didn't know how to process that question. They're like, well, what kinds of trees are in the forest? Oak or birch or this? And they're like, well, yeah, all of those. Yeah, but which one?
Like, but they must not mix.
Yeah, and I was like, but it is a mix. Like, they're, you know, you have oak and chestnut and, you know, pine and all this stuff together.
Yeah.
Nope.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, I mean,
well, there was the tree segment anyway.
Well, and you said some stuff about, like, some of the bird calls you noticed.
Oh yes, I noticed a green woodpecker yaffling. This is a call that a green woodpecker does. I don't know if you even have green woodpeckers in Russia.
Yeah,
so.
I have no idea.
Yeah, whether they just included it because it sounded good.
Probably. This happens quite a lot where you hear a bird called a bee eater, which is a beautiful kind of rainbow coloured bird, and it lives in Africa or Spain. Sometimes in sort of British dramas, you'll hear in a sort of woodland setting, you'll hear a bee eater calling and you're like, don't think that would be there.
Nice.
There's like a handful of records of them coming over here. But yeah, I wonder if the little random woodpecker was just popped in there for effect. Or you might get eagles, like in random places. You often, if there's like a mountain setting somewhere, you hear this like an eagle and you're like, no, there wouldn't be an eagle there actually, unless you're in Scotland or something.
Nice.
So that's something I notice anyway. There's always something, if you have any field of expertise, I imagine, if you're watching a film, that you spot and you go, that's not right.
Yeah. All right. So, does this make you want to check out the book, Jenny?
Well, I've had such mixed reviews. Carrie loves it. You forgot it. So.
Well, that's because Carrie is a better reader than me.
And she did read it before watching the film. Maybe I don't have that.
I read it, you know, first 10 years ago or something, you know, and our Russian professors were almost like, you must love this book because it is so amazing. And I think I liked it better the second time I read it because it wasn't like, I must read this and write a paper on it.
Sure, yeah.
So I could just go at my own pace, but I did like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I might check it out, actually. And it's made me want to check out more about Pushkin. He sounds like he's got an interesting backstory himself, and sort of the works that he did and his influence.
And his sideburns.
Yes, and more importantly, his sideburns.
Yeah. One of these days we'll have to cover that movie.
Which
There's
one?
There's a movie called Sideburns.
Pushkin Sideburns.
Well, it's called Sideburns, but it's about these, like, Pushkinists. It's very weird.
I was joking, but this sounds like actually is a movie.
It is actually a movie
where they dress like him and they grow out these insane sideburns.
And they beat people up with canes.
While reciting Pushkin's poems.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. How did you rate this as a period drama? Would this appeal to other period drama fans? Is it
a good example
of the genre?
I think it is, yeah. It is a good example of the genre. It seems quite faithful to its original text and the sort of spirit of the book. It seems to get, apart from the green woodpecker, it seems to get a lot of the details right. I thought the costumes were fantastic. It seemed to me like a kind of, well, it was 1828, and that seems spot on. You've got those big puffy sleeves, and the Empire Line has sort of started to move down into this sort of more like two triangles touching sort of silhouette for the woman, and the hairdo and the dropped shoulder neckline and stuff. So I was like, yep, that makes me think it is set around that time, and it turned out that it was. So yeah, it seemed pretty spot on. And again, if you like watching a period drama for the same reason as I do, that you kind of escaped that other world and you get a little glimpse, even though it's fiction, of life in sort of 1820s Russia, or certainly that level of society and those people, then yeah, I think it does that job admirably.
Awesome. Any final thoughts from you, Carrie?
No, I mean, generally I liked it. I mean, like I said, I liked the book better, but I encourage you to both read the book and watch the movie.
Again, very balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much both for joining me for this episode.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a lot of fun.
Am I supposed to say thank you for having me as well?
No.
Because you know I don't mean it.
Making...
This is why you don't invite her on the podcast. I think Carrie enjoys making trouble.
Yeah. You really should check out that other episode. It's a nightmare. But yes, anyway. So, Jenny, is there anywhere online or whatever that you'd like to direct people towards?
Ooh, yeah, you can come and say hi on Twitter. My handle is @JennySheltonCam. Because I used to be affiliated with the Cambridge News, but now I can't change my Twitter handle. So CAM stands for Cambridge, in case you wondered.
Yeah. Well, you'd be kind of starting from scratch, which is a pain once you've established.
There is @JennyShelton, but she hasn't tweeted, and it's so maddening. And I'm like, I want that handle. But apparently Twitter can't do anything about that.
That's unfortunate. There should be like a, you know, use it within like 5 years or it lapses.
Yeah. Dormancy rules.
Yeah.
But I'm on Twitter. I tweet a lot about birds and wildlife.
How appropriate.
Yeah, indeed. But also some culture for balance.
Although I suspect that Twitter wouldn't have grown to the extent that it has if it had been strictly, you know, ornithological stuff.
Well, it should be, really, by its very name.
Yeah. This is a bird-based only form of social media.
You must only talk about birds. That could fill a lot of Twitter. In fact, there's a lot of very interesting stuff which I try and retweet about birds. I'm trying to think of a fact that I can back that up with. I have a good one for you. I don't know if this is going out before Easter, but the origin of the Easter Bunny story is rooted in a bird myth, which is...
That's counterintuitive.
Well, I guess so, yeah. I mean, it's kind of... So, lapwings are a kind of bird that you might have seen, sort of black and white with a little flicky bit at the back. And they live in sort of farmland areas, and they lay their eggs in fields just sort of straight on the ground, but they often lay them in little scrapes that are made by hares. So back in the days of yore, to be specific, people would wander around the fields and see lapwings and hares in the same field together, and then they also might come across lapwing eggs in the hare scrapes. So they put two and two together and made 10 and said, oh my god, the rabbits, the hares are laying the eggs. And nice. that's the origin of the Easter Bunny story.
Oh, awesome.
Wow. There's a little bird fact for you.
Did not know that. That's cool.
Well, on that note...
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me again. And thank you, listeners. And da svidaniya, folks.
Da svidaniya.
Cheerio.
Hello again. So I am back, albeit briefly, to say thanks again for listening. I'll be back in a month's time with another episode. In the meantime, it would be great to hear from you, so you can say hi on Twitter @RoosFilesU. So that's RoosFiles with letter U at the end. There's the Facebook page and associated group, so come check out that, say hi, we discuss films and stuff, as you might imagine. And yeah, you could always email if you want to send a longer message, so that would be roosfilesunite@gmail.com. If you can spare a minute or two to rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you pick the show up from, that would really, really be massively, massively appreciated. In fact, I wanted to do something I've not done before on this podcast, and I'm actually going to read out a review. So here it is. This is from Jalakar, and Jalakar is from Poland, and the title of their review is Well Balanced and Engaging. And then the rest of the review goes, it's great to hear engaging content related to the niche of Russian films, informative and enjoyable. So thanks very much, Jalakar, that's awesome. And yeah, if anyone else out there has a minute or two to spare to write a review, that would obviously be fantastic. All right then, folks, thanks again for listening, and goodbye.